So we had an on-time departure and almost an on-time arrival as well. But Dr. West, we're very, very grateful to you for sharing your insights and your challenge, as well as your vulnerability and open to questions yourself. And he has he's very graciously given his time. So we'd invite members of the audience to write down any questions that you have. I think there are cards out there. There are members of the staff. For those of you who did not make it into the Mayer Theater tonight and are watching remotely, there are people to pick up your questions too. And Professor Chang will then begin a question and answer sessions with our audience members and Professor West. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mick. Thank you again, Dr. West, for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, your integrity, your courage. You spoke so profoundly and soberingly about death and the forms of death. And I will begin then with the definition, Professor Ruth Wilson Gilmore's definition of racism. Mm-hmm. Professor Ruth Wilson Gilmore defines racism, quote, "The state-sanctioned production of group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death." The state-sanctioned production of group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. Yusuf Hawkins, Amadou Diallo, Sean Bell, Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Renisha McBride, Eric Garner, Mike Brown, John Crawford. Brothers and sisters that were taken from us too soon. I have another quote from Professor Tryon Woods, quote, "The violence to which black people are subjected is gratuitous." So I'd like to begin with the difficult question of the specificity of anti-black racism, acknowledging that there are many racisms and many forms of oppression. It often seems that the particularity of anti-black racism gets lost in our contemporary concepts of, quote, diversity, quote, the multiracial. And by anti-black racism, I include this oscillation between denigration and idealization. There's a denigration violence against blackness that sometimes gets covered over by an idealization of blackness. Let me add some more controversy here. We know about the color line between whiteness and non-whiteness. There's also a color line between blackness and non-blackness. There's an argument that critical race scholars have made that that there is, a specificity to anti-black racism, not experienced by other groups of color, although other groups of color are subjected to their own forms of racism. So again, quoting from Professor Tryon Woods, quote, "Is blackness but one among a diversity of subjectivities? Or is the rupture that blackness represents so essential to the formation of the social itself that any analysis of violence or injustice that is not centered in, derived from, or accountable to the suffering of African-descended peoples risks missing the crux of the social formation?" There are many faces of human suffering, but to me, it does seem that there is something particularly, quote, gratuitous about the spectacle of black suffering. And I would also add something gratuitous about spectacles of idealized blackness, a kind of fascination or obsession with idealized blackness as well. Thank you. Question. What do you think of this idea that we need to acknowledge the specificity of anti-black racism, including those who value, quote, diversity and multiracial coalition? And another possible question, how can we think about breaking the pattern of idealizing blackness, which runs the risk of appropriating the spirit of blackness while leaving actual black folks behind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got a lot on the table there, my dear sister. But I appreciate you going through
it,
because these are very important. Yeah, the audience, this is a highly, not just sophisticated audience, but a highly loquacious audience in terms of the nomenclature and the vocabulary. Let me put it this way, that I mean, I usually talk about white supremacy because it's a species of racism. I mean, you've got different kinds of hatreds and subordinations of different peoples that can go on. It could be Arabs, it could be Jews, it could be Latinos and so forth. But white supremacy against African peoples in a particular history, I see it as the terrorizing, the traumatizing, and the stigmatizing of these people that keep them so intimidated, afraid, and scared that they never want to straighten their backs out, tell the truth, and fight back. And this is very important even in terms of our new black immigrants. You see, even the immigrants from the Caribbean, you see, our precious Caribbean brothers and sisters, when they come to the United States, they experience very ugly forms of slavery, but they didn't have American terrorism in Jamaica. They didn't have Jim Crow in Jamaica. They didn't have massive lynching in Jamaica. They had a British colonial experience that's very different. So even though they're beautifully black, the way Negroes were beautifully black, they have different historical experience. And that's one reason why in America, in the Jim Crow bus, if you dressed up like an African, you could sit in the front of the bus. If you were a Negro, you went to the back. But you were still a black African, but you were not a Negro. Because the Negro had been targeted, had been niggerized in a particular kind of way to keep them so scared, precisely because the mainstream knew, the status quo has always known, that black rage is the major threat to the status quo. And that's why black rage is usually always understood as black revenge on the white side of town. Martin Luther King had black rage, but he never talked about black revenge. Malcolm, I said, he's moving back and forth. He complicates things, you see. But why is that so? It's because it's not just anti-black racism in the abstract. You keeping track of Jamal and Letitia because they have memories of wounds and scars that no language will ever be able to even partially capture. That's why Toni Morrison dedicates Beloved to the millions whose bones in the body of Atlanta and who were Jim Crowed and terrorized. Because remember, now, American black people, American Negroes were enslaved and then made citizens for 12 years and then subordinated and dominated into sub-citizenship, another form of slavery, but not the old slavery, up until 1965. So that history is very, very important. That's part of historical specificity that you're talking about. And that's another reason why so much of it's really a kind of attack on the masses of black people in the last 30 years, the level of soul murder that takes place in the educational system has yet to be fully documented. It's unbelievable. I've taught in prisons for 37 years. I still teach at Rahway. To see the brothers coming in at 18 and 19 and what they have been up against. But if somehow you can re-niggerize the black professional class, which is to give them big money and position, but to keep them scared in terms of telling the truth, and distance them from the black working poor and working class, so that their fate is no longer linked together in their minds, then you end up treating these precious black poor children and black poor people as if they are superfluous people or subhuman. No group would ever allow their families to have to go through the level of social neglect, economic abandon, tight police surveillance, shot down every 28 hours. Some black youth shot down every 28 hours, not by a black person, that's even more, by the police. It has genocidal implications. It does. Then the question becomes, where are the voices? Well, if your black leadership is mainly concerned with black middle class issues, then you have churches that have no building, that have no prison ministry, but the building fund is busting out all over. And the pastor getting the third car and breakdancing. Ain't got nothing to do with the gospel. Ain't got nothing to do with the gospel. The blood at the cross, just Kool-Aid to dip in. Ain't real blood for transformation. It's just money making. Pastors, the CEO, we can go on and on. So what happens? Well, these folk reach a certain point where their rage begins to become manifest. Ferguson could very well be that moment. That's why we're going to Ferguson on the 10th and 13th of October. We're going to have a massive civil disobedience. We're going to have thousands of folk try to fill the jails like Birmingham. And we're going to have one fundamental aim. It's going to be critique of the system, yes. It's going to be, we want justice, yes. We want the policemen arrested, yes. We want a fair trial, yes. But most importantly, we want to say to the precious young brothers, we love you. The young sisters, we care for you. Somebody cares and loves you enough, they're going to put their body on the line to go into jail. And why? Not because we're so good, but because we are who we are because somebody loved us. We wouldn't be. I don't care if you're a black CEO. I don't care if you're a black president, a black professor. You wouldn't be who you are if somebody hadn't loved you. Usually on the chocolate side of town, but not exclusively, because we got white folk who love too. Negroes. You see. But that's the message that needs to be. And that's the kind of love renaissance, justice renaissance that we need. And the young folk are hungry for it, because too many of them just feel unloved, uncared for, forgotten, tossed out. Disposable, superfluous. That's the worst thing you could do. One of the worst things you can do, other than what happened during slavery, what happened to our Jewish brothers and sisters during the Holocaust, which is what? Not allow people to bury their dead. Going right back to our understanding of humando. When people are not allowed for the last moment to give dignity to their dead. And of course, under U.S. slavery, that happened because usually after funerals, it generated slave insurrections. Because when you reach that visceral level of seeing that little baby standing there, you say, I'm going for broke. That's Gabriel Broza. That was a slave insurrection. 6,000 slaves organized at that little precious baby's funeral. And Gabriel couldn't take it no more. And a whole lot of others couldn't take it no more either. Say, we're going to not allow these people to bury their dead no more. Looks like each time they had a funeral, somebody gets up, give a speech, ready to talk about revolution. Indeed, indeed. Now we got Michael Brown, Continuum, and so many others. And it's not just a male thing, because there's young black sisters in the hood catching hell too. Catching hell too. It's not just the black brothers, but it's both of them. And we got to go down swinging with the love, but also with the willingness to sacrifice. That's a long answer. I'm going to be much shorter. I promise.
We got a lot of great questions from the audience. What is the fate and future of protest today? I would like to hear you reflect further on Ferguson and what it means, especially the alliance between Ferguson, Palestine, and now Hong Kong protesters.
You may
have heard that the Hong Kong protesters have used the hands up, don't shoot gesture.
Yeah, I mean, I think the future of protest is always rooted in the willingness of persons to protest. It depends on how much people are willing. Now, it's true that, I mean, if we're moving toward police states and you're moving toward neo-fascist states, then it's much more difficult to engage in protest. The kind of militarization of local police, and of course, this has been going on for 6 or 7 years. I know Brother Eric Holder and so forth is on his way out, and he made some gestures at the end, but he actually forced that he was under his aegis that during the 6 years he was there, there was the escalation of the militarizing of the local police. He and the president knew that was going on. They just got caught with Ferguson, that's all. Then all of a sudden they get exposed, and all of a sudden they act like, oh my God, we need a review. We don't need no review. You should have stopped it in the first place, man. Come on, my brother. You just got exposed, you see? Just got exposed. And the Black Congressional Caucus, 70% I'm voted for. Then gonna act like they so mad. Oh my God, this is inhumane. Why'd you vote for it, Negro? Because you thought you could just slide it through because it didn't have any public spotlight. What they gonna use those militarized weapons for? What other use does it have to intensify the police surveillance over the poor brothers and sisters locked into the hood? You knew exactly what it was, but the Defense Department and the arms industry, profit-driven, was pushing it on them. And where did they get their money for elections? The same folk. You see, and it's true for politicians, whatever color, but you just have to be honest about it. And just tell the people that. You see, so they get upset a lot of times when I tell the people that. And I ask them, I say, well, am I lying? Well, no. Then what's the problem? Well, you shouldn't air the dirty linen like that. No. It's your dirty linen impacting these precious people. I don't air dirty linen just to be airing dirty linen. If it's connected to subordination of God's people, then it has to be revealed and disclosed lovingly. Tough love. A love to get you in trouble.
I've been given the signal to end with a last question. I'm going to group some questions together.
Ooh, we got to take more time. Just that little. Lord. We got to take a little bit. Where's my brother? We take more time. We keep it going. Oh, yeah. No. We take more time. Absolutely. No, okay. I appreciate it. No. Unless they're having a concert in the room, then we got to move out, you know.
Okay, let me group some questions together. This is actually a great tension between these questions. First, how would you attempt to integrate your theological conclusions on what it means to be human being into our current social and governmental structure, especially with the separation of church and state? How do we institute a moral compass into government and economy? Another question, is the true secularization of government needed to make progress?
Yeah, those are tough questions. I mean, one is that we should never confuse the separation of church and state, or synagogue and state, or temple and state, synagogue and state, with religion and politics. You see, every political sphere, every public life is going to have religious people in it. They're going to have citizens concerned with public interest who understand public interest in light of their religious tradition. And there's nothing wrong with that, because you have to have robust rights and liberties across the board. Freedom of expression, freedom of religion. I'm not just talking about freedom of religion, other religions that we respect. You see, as a Christian, I will fight for a polytheist to express his or her views. In the same way that I fight for Brother Rush Limbaugh to be wrong. He has a right to be wrong. He's got a right to raise his voice and be wrong, make a fool of himself. Hey, that's cool, Rush. I'm fighting for your right to do that, because liberties are precious. Not a matter of agreeing with anybody. They have a right to raise their voices, and then you come with the arguments and so forth and so on. Reveal what financial sources, if they're tied to simply echoing those interests and whatever, you see. So that in that sense, there's always going to be a tie between religion and politics, but the state itself must not in any way tilt toward one particular religious tradition that could result in authoritarian treatment of not just other religious tradition, but of our priceless atheists and agnostics, who are citizens and have equal status in public life as agnostics and as atheists. That's very important. That's very important. Now, of course, on the other hand, it can't just tilt toward the atheists. I wrestle with this Brother Bill Maher all the time. He's a militant atheist, because when he looks at religion, all he sees is crusades, domination, and there's a whole lot to see. I mean, look at the Christian church itself. The Christian church is founded on Peter. What did Peter do at a crucial moment? Denied him three times. Now, if the church is denied, it's founded on that brother. Three-time denial. Now, he bounced back strong in his faith and was stoned. Yes, he did. But if a church is founded on a brother who denies him three times, acting like you didn't even know him, and you hanging out with him on intimate terms, it means you have a human institution that's trying to make space for a gospel, a good news that's bigger than just the humans themselves, but it's always going to be in some sense colonized, in some sense bastardized, because of our fallenness. And it's almost a miracle that some of the gospel gets through most of our church as. That'll make you believe in miracles right there. But I'd say the same thing about Judaism. All that rich prophetic energy in Judaism, and you end up with many of these rabbis who can't keep track of Palestinian human beings. What's going on? Amos got something to say about that. Isaiah got something to say about that. Same is true with the Islamic brothers and sisters. With Muhammad, pluralism in Mecca and Medina, mercy, love. Then you run into ISIS. Oh, Lord. ISIS is nothing but the Klan. But to keep in mind, there's over 1,000 white supremacist militia in America. And there's probably, for every socialist in America, there's probably 2 or 3 Klansmen. So that'll give you a little sobriety in terms of dealing with your fellow citizens when it comes to progressives, when it comes to prophetic witness that we live in a nation in which the right wing is, in fact, very, very powerful in terms of the perceptions and in terms of the capacity to organize and mobilize. And that's another reason, again, why it's very important that there be a state that is not completely open to being colonized by religious traditions, because there's a good chance it would be colonized by the more religiously tied to forms of domination that would suppress the voices of the Amoses and the Dorothy Days. And, of course, in some ways, that's been the history, too, in terms of being. So that in that sense, I'm very much a Democrat, small d. Radical Democrat, small d. And that has a radical libertarian, but it also has a deep suspicion of authoritarian possibilities of the state and corporations, too. Mm-hmm.
Okay, another set of questions. Dr. West, if we reflect on the lives of progressives like Mandela and Gandhi, we see an outward love that excluded these individuals' immediate dependents and wives. Is this a necessary sacrifice, or is this an aspect of leadership that we should more carefully reanalyze? Slightly different question, can you expand on the role of black women in the black prophetic tradition?
Oh, Lord have mercy. I mean, that second question, the black sisters. Oh, yes, my God. I mean, I alluded to Ida B. Wells and Ella Baker and Harriet Tubman. We can go on and on and on. A lot of times they are women who exercise magnificent leadership by not being in the spotlight, just getting the work done at the level of execution, not just symbolic presentation. Now, a lot of that is because of patriarchal leadership in churches and so on. But a lot of it also has to do with the fact that the formation of male egos in a patriarchal society is shot through with levels of insecurity. Deep insecurity. It's highly competitive, linked to envy of the other. Who has this, who doesn't have this, who has a bigger X or Y, I won't go into the details on that. But that's what it is to be constructed in a patriarchal world for brothers. And then, of course, when you add race to it, it gets even more ugly, you see. And that was part of that idealizing that you talked about, you see. You can exoticize and primitivize black people and black men so they become the major persons who will entertain you, almost like the gladiators at the end of the Roman Empire. Everybody can't wait to see the gladiators do their thing. But as soon as the event is over, you want to make sure you keep them under control. You see. And so many black men are oriented in that way. I mean, that was my own experience in Sacramento, that when I was growing up, my heroes, other than my father and Reverend Willie P. Cook of Shiloh Baptist Church, were Willie Mays and James Brown. I'm not ashamed of that. I think Willie Mays was one of the greatest athletes. James Brown is one of the greatest artists. But those were the two options for a young black boy. You see, hit the good foot with James, pick up your glove and be like Willie. And every once in a while, little Jesse Owens in the background, you know I wasn't going to be Joe Louis because I'm not built the way. I was strong, but I couldn't do no Joe Louis kind of activity. Those are the two. Why? Because not only those were confined, those were the confining roles for black boys, and they still are today. It was hip-hop, football, basketball. Baseball, less so. No hockey at all. Not yet. We thought golf, but Tiger was doing it for a while, but he's got his challenges now. But what does that mean? You know, what that means is that black women who historically have been at the center, not just 70% of the churches across the board without being able to gain access to the leadership, but also in the movement. Also at home. Also in civic institutions. Sororities, a.k.a. Delta, across the board. Fundamental agents. And we're in a moment now where it's beginning to become more and more visible. But then the question will be, you know, the system is such that, you know, the system is just looking for black versions of Margaret Thatcher. You see? They're looking for black versions of CEO Wall Street folk. I mean, that's the challenge of Oprah, isn't it? That's the challenge of Oprah. We broke our necks trying to get on her show when we were involved in the struggle against apartheid. Couldn't get on. But when Nelson Mandela gets out, she run over there and hug him when the cameras are on. He said, wait a minute, Sister Oprah. When it's time to take a risk, you wasn't there. But now, and then you got a school there. That's beautiful. But she's a marketeer. Entrepreneurial genius, not a lot of political courage. So the women can easily be incorporated, diluted, like the brothers can, or anybody else. And that's going to be a challenge. It's just, I think it's going to be much more difficult. I think actually when the story is told about Sister Michelle and Brother Barack, 10, 15 years from now, when the real truths come out, there's going to be some deep tensions, very deep tensions. And it's not just because she's a Negro and he isn't. That's not the only reason. Because we got some great Africans. We got some great folk of different colors who side with the struggle, you see. But her history is one in which she finds it much more difficult for the language that he uses when he talks about black youth. There's no doubt about that. Now, I ain't saying, I haven't been inside of their marriage. These are all hypotheses that I'm trotting out. But when the truth is actually told, my hunch is there is some tension there. Why? Because she does have a set of lens that she's looking at. Both of them brilliant, but they're different. They're different. Indonesia and white grandparents from Kansas. And I'm not talking about Wizard of Oz. It's a different formation. Different sensitivity. Different kind of priority, you see. That he could choose to go, but his orientation can easily go the other way. Hers is going to be a little bit more difficult. But I'm not saying that she herself could not be co-opted. All of us are co-optable, no matter what gender, you see. But I do think it's going to be more difficult for black women to get co-opted the way we brothers have in the last 30 years. That's very real, no doubt about it.
A little bit related. The Jesuit Catholic tradition is prophetic. But what about the people catching hell in our own house? Women call to priestly ministry, LGBTQ community, etc. Related question, how do we face death in order to be reborn in a place of privilege at Santa Clara University? Is it possible?
Well, one, I think it's very important to keep in mind that each time we're talking about prophetic fire, prophetic practice, we're always talking about a slice of any tradition, you see. See, my claim was not that the black tradition is prophetic across the board. I was talking about the black prophetic elements in the black tradition. And the same is true with Jesuits. See, the Jesuit tradition is not across the board prophetic. There's prophetic figures, voices within the Jesuit tradition. And the question is, how do you expand that? How do you broaden that? And I was asking the best of the Jesuits. Now, if you want me to come back and give a lecture on the worst of the Jesuit educational thing, you could rest be assured that I'd get some, I could mobilize some evidence. But that's true for all of our traditions, Judaism, Islam, whatever, across the board, you see. That second question was
How do we face death in order to be reborn in a place of such privilege as Santa Clara University?
Oh, no. I mean, see, the thing about it is that our humanity is never reducible to just a category. Never. Because we always have the capacity to choose. So you can choose to critique your white privilege, your male privilege, your straight privilege, your imperial privilege. You can come from the upper classes. I mean, the Vanderbilts produced communists. Cornelius had relatives who were communists. He completely called into question. John Rockefeller was a socialist. That wasn't hegemonic in the family. But John the Grandson was a socialist. Laura Rockefeller supported the feminist movement, didn't she? That is to say, they choose to go against the grain of their families. And that's true for privilege in Santa Clara University. You come here, you read, you say, my God, I've been fed a number of lies. I need to learn how to die in order to learn how to live. Ooh. Then you got this magnificent faculty will say, we'll teach you how to learn how to die lovingly, step by step, stage by stage. But I don't want any one of us to think that we are imprisoned by any category. Our humanity means we have the capacity to change, not just be informed, but transformed in our education. And I do think that there's strong elements of that in the Jesuit educational tradition, and that fundamental stress on transformation tied to a learning how to die by loving your way through darkness, tied to a cross that provides you some kind of hope. Absolutely.
I'm getting signals that we have a few more minutes. I think we can do two sets of questions, and then Dr. West will be doing a book signing. The first set of questions: can you share a moment where you experienced a form of rebirth? Related, perhaps, if somehow you met a young version of yourself, what is the key piece of wisdom you would pass on?
Yeah, I think it would go back to the Du Bois quote, though. I think that for anybody who makes a fundamental commitment to sustain integrity with a longevity will be countercultural and counter-hegemonic. Intellectual integrity, spiritual integrity, moral integrity, a willingness to follow the truth, linked to the suffering of the least of these. And a younger version is to do that in your own way. Imitation is suicide. Ralph Emerson is right. It's not a matter of imitating any human being. It's a matter of building on the example of other human beings as you find your voice as a young sister or a young brother, no matter what color. And that's what I say to young people all the time. I mean, part of the problem, because I spend a lot of time in hip-hop studios, and I tell the brothers and sisters when I come in the studio that I come from a tradition of people who had the courage to attempt to be originals. And among the young people, I see too many copies. See, because in America, to be a copy is to be able to fit in. Nobody wants to be a misfit. Well, you see, the whole movement for justice is being a misfit. The whole movement of justice is being maladjusted to injustice. It's not well-adjusted injustice. So if you're fearful, just want to be a echo. We're talking about that the Negro National Anthem is lift every voice, not lift every echo. If you just want to be an echo, and you're just reflecting somebody else or a mainstream, then you might be highly successful. But the fundamental question is, what are you faithful to? Being successful and faithful are two qualitatively different things. Very, very different things. We live in a time in which we tell young people that life is more and more about smartness and dollars. And I say, let the phones be smart. We got to be wise and compassionate. And yes, we need our dollars, but if you view life as a gold rush, you not only end up worshiping a golden calf, but you reduce the golden rule to those who have the gold rule. And if you reach that point, then the fascism becomes the alternative. Might makes right, period. And anybody who raises their voices, pick up your cross, deny yourself, follow, and be ready to die. And that's what happens in authoritarian societies. We've seen that historically across the board. But you all have been so kind and so patient. But thank you so very, very much. And stay strong in your work. Stay strong in your work. God bless you. God bless you. Santa Clara University. Jesuit education. Faith. Justice. Learning. Community.